Savitri. This is the entry into the inner countries, and Sri Aurobindo is saying that God makes himself mortal, puts on mortal ignorance for his cloak, and makes himself the dwarf with triple stride. So this image of the dwarf with triple stride, this is the Vaman avatar, right? And he means the triple stride means the physical, vital, and mental. Bhu, bhuvar, swa, right?
Lupa, I'm sorry, I actually kind of missed the first part of what you were saying
Yeah,
because I had
let
to
me
get up.
start again.
Can you repeat?
Yeah, I had a question about an image that Sri Aurobindo used in this Canto 3. I mean, page 488, and he says that
Which book,
this
Canto 3?
is the book of how do I see? It's where Savit the book 7, book of
Okay.
yoga.
Okay.
So there the voice is telling Savitri, only if God assumes the human mind and puts on mortal ignorance for his cloak and makes himself the dwarf with triple stride, can he help man to grow into the God? So I was just asking about this dwarf with triple stride. Is this the Vamana avatar, right?
Yes, you're quite right. I mean, it's a reference that veiled reference to Vaman Avatar, but this is also the psychic being. In fact, Vaman Avatar is also, to some extent, a reference to the psychic being, which enters into the ignorance as a kind of a quintessential human, like a dwarf. But the triple stride, you're right, is the physical, vital and mental beings that it manages to sort of integrate and control, command. But in the traditional Puranic description of the Vaman Avatar, it is more, the sort of, well, maybe I guess it is those three worlds. They're talking there of the underworld, earth and heaven, right? In the case of the Vaman Avatar. As the three strides. He makes a distinction, actually, there's an interesting distinction he does make of this kind when he's talking about the three strides of Vishnu in the Veda. He,
Vishnu.
you know, there's a hymn to Veda, a hymn to Vishnu in the Veda, where there is a mention of his three fast striding Vishnu. Okay, so he talks there about the three strides being those three strides of the material, vital and mental worlds, and then leading him into the super mind. So that in when he makes reference to that, he also sort of has a comment about the Vaman Avatar, where he says, not as in the Puranic case where his triple strides are restricted to the lower worlds, the mid worlds, and the heaven. Notion of the three worlds is slightly different in the Puranic description, but he adapts it, and he sort of points out that in the Vedas, those three strides are a little different.
Are you talking of they call him Vishnu Rurukrama?
Yes. Commentary to that, you'll find a mention there of the dwarf avatar.
Where is this passage?
I don't have that with me right now, but I think if you look at Secret of the Veda, you'll find it.
Secret. All right. Actually, I did read it. All right. Let's continue then. I think we are in page 803.
Yes.
I believe we finished discussing this resort must continue in the internatal stage.
Yeah, I think you're right.
So we should start with the next paragraph for when we
Yes.
say. Vince, do you want to start?
Yeah, sure. Can you hear me?
Yeah, pretty nice.
Yeah. For when we say that the soul on earth evolves successively, the physical, the vital, the mental, the spiritual being, we do not mean that it creates them and that they had no previous existence. On the contrary, what it does is to manifest these principles of its spiritual entity under the conditions imposed by a world of physical nature. This manifestation takes the form of a structure of frontal personality, which is a translation of the inner self into the terms and possibilities of the physical existence. In fact, we must accept the ancient idea that man has within him not only the physical soul of Purusha with its appropriate nature, but a vital, a mental, a psychic, a supramental, a supreme spiritual being, and either the whole or the greater presence or force of them is concealed in his subliminal or latent and unformulated in his superconscient parts. He has to bring forward their powers in his active consciousness and to awake to them in its knowledge. But each of these powers of his being is in relation with its own proper plane of existence, and all have their roots there. It is through them that there takes place the subliminal resort of the being to the shaping influences from above, a resort which may become more and more conscious as we develop. It is logical then that according to the development of their powers in our conscious evolution should be the internatal resort which this nature of our birth here in its evolutionary object and process necessitate. The circumstances and the stages of that resort must be complex and not of the crudely and trenchantly simple character which the popular religions imagine. But in itself, it can be accepted as an inevitable consequence of the very origin and nature of the soul life in the body. All is a closely woven web, an evolution and an interaction whose links have been forged by a conscious force following out the truth of its own motives according to a dynamic logic of these finite workings of the infinite.
So here Sri Aurobindo is continuing the idea that he has introduced earlier, that it is to the degree that the organization and settlement of the forces and powers of the other worlds in us has taken place, that the life of the soul in its journey beyond this life will be able to have its place and activity. And this this is mainly because, as he points out, that not only do we have a physical existence, but we have a being, in other words, both the Purusha and the Prakriti. Actually, first only a Purusha, but then gradually developing a Prakriti, that is the formation, even in the higher planes of our own existence, individual existence. And so to the extent that these other sheets are organized in us, that they are active because of the operation of the forces of those worlds to which they are native, we have our journey beyond life. And he relates this entire process to the evolution of nature. The circumstances, he says, it is logical then that according to the development of their powers in our conscious evolution should be the internatal resort which this nature of our birth here and its evolutionary object and process necessitate. So the development of their powers in our conscious evolution, in other words, that term conscious evolution, refers to the progress of the psychic being. That is what evolves in us. It is the psychic entity putting forward the psychic personality, developing greater and greater control, influence and control over the nature, drawing down into the Prakriti the forces of these worlds so as to have a certain kind of settled nature that constitute this whole process of conscious evolution within us. This process of conscious evolution becomes conscious to our outer personality once we enter into yoga. It is just as if that which is already active becomes accelerated due to the adherence of all those parts that are ignorant to its purpose. So the circumstances and the stages of that resort must be complex and not of the crudely and trenchantly simple character which the popular religions imagine. So here basically, you know, that's why it is really to the degree and extent of the formations within us. It is not some stereotypical, it's totally subjective from that point of view. Not some stereotype of, you know, kind of understanding that this journey proceeds. But in itself, it can be accepted as an inevitable consequence of the very origin and nature of the soul life in the body. All is a closely woven web, an evolution and an interaction whose links have been forged by a conscious force, following up the truth of its own motives according to a dynamic logic of these finite workings of the infinite. Infinite has individualized itself and is moving towards its own self-knowledge, self-control and power over its own nature. And that entire process is being carried out by the Chit Shakti, by the Chit Tapas, which is the conscious force. So it is interwoven or woven, this whole, all is a closely woven web, this relation of the individual and the cosmos, and the dynamic process by which this relationship becomes real to the individual is something which is being orchestrated by the conscious force, by the Chit Shakti. He makes reference here when he's talking of those different beings to the Taittiriya Upanishad. And of course, he's referring there to Bhrigus Tapasya. That's why he says there. Let's look at that sentence once. This manifestation takes the form of a structure of frontal personality, which is a translation of the inner self into the terms and possibilities of the physical existence. In fact, we must accept the ancient idea that man has within him not only the physical soul of Purusha with its appropriate nature, but a vital, a mental, a psychic, a supramental, a supreme spiritual being, and either the whole or the greater presence or force of them is concealed in his subliminal or latent and unformulated in his superconscient parts. This is very interesting because that's what, you know, the whole idea of the Prakriti. In the lower parts, you see, you have a surface person. Surface personality is that which is operating in the physical. And the physical Purusha behind it, and it is an amalgam of forces from the vital and the mental. But of course, there is a true vital Prakriti and a true mental Prakriti with the mental Purushas behind it that are latent in the subliminal and active to some extent, depending on to what extent one has become conscious of the inner being and operates from there. And then we move to the higher Purushas, as in this case, the supramental and the supreme spiritual Purushas. The supreme spiritual in the Taittiriya case is the Ananda Purusha. Now, those particular Prakritis are not organized, not sort of created at all, not formulated at all. That's why he uses the term there, unformulated. See what he says. Unformulated in his superconscient, concealed in his subliminal or latent and unformulated in his superconscient parts. So that is it, that by power of yoga becomes the task of the individual. That is the conscious evolution he is talking about. The unconscious evolution proceeds to a certain degree and then it must become conscious. In fact, one may say the presence of the psychic being is already the beginning of the conscious evolution in the human being, though unknown to the surface personality. But that becomes even more conscious with the acceptance of the intent of its evolutionary purpose in the surface personality. Then that dynamizes its, you know, movement, so that which was subliminal starts coming to the front. There is direct action of the mental Purusha on the mental Prakriti, direct action of the vital Purusha on the vital Prakriti, and of the physical Purusha on the physical Prakriti, with the psychic being ruling these. But there is also more and more the access to the levels of mind above the human mind, what Sri Aurobindo calls the spiritual mind planes. And the power of the mental Purusha shifts its center to move there and form a personality there. The mental personality becomes more formed there, which is now unformulated. So when, for example, Sri Aurobindo says that after his nirvanic experience, he stopped thinking with the mind and took his seat above the mind. See, now this taking the seat above the mind, in the beginning, it is actually the movement of the station of the mental Purusha from the Ajna Chakra to the Sahasrara. From there, it controls the rest of the mental being and has access to the planes above. Now, ultimately, it will take its seat in the overmind. That is the beginning of the overmental transformation. It will rise to take its seat in the overmind and form for itself the mental personality, the prakriti, mental prakriti, which is an overmental prakriti. Thereafter, it will move further into the supermind. So, the supramental Purusha, which is cosmic or rather transcendental, will have to be united with, to some extent, the psychic being enters into union with the supramental Purusha, and therefrom it controls the nature, but first it has to form the nature, the form the individualized nature at that plane. So that is essentially that unformulated part which needs to be formulated. See? So that becomes the entire journey of conscious evolution, that conscious force has given to itself by creating this closed web, making possible this journey of the soul.
Debashishda, could you explain what is meant by formulation? When the Purusha takes its station in one of the higher plane, so at that time it is still unformulated, or the taking of that station is already the culmination, or at least is already a formulation?
No, the formulation is of the prakriti. Okay, so you see, the Purusha and either the whole or the greater presence of force of them is concealed. See, the force of them is what is the presence of force, he's saying, is concealed in his subliminal or latent and unformulated in his superconscient parts. That the power of these Purushas, the Purushas are already there, but to what extent are they mobilized in our individualized existences? That becomes the question. So when he's talking about unformulated presence and power, they can only get formulated to the extent that a prakriti is formed for them. So the formation of a prakriti is that formulation he's talking about. Nature already gives us already pre-formulated physical, vital and mental beings, and physical, vital and mental nature. But an individualized supramental nature, individualized supramental Anandamaya nature, is not something formulated. It has to be formed. That's making that formation is part of the journey of the conscious evolution.
Thank you, Devashish.
This is actually quite a, you know, profound thing, because you see, idea of uniting with higher Purushas is what is usually envisaged. That indeed they are latent, so we do it that naturally we don't have any link. The what is known as the avidya, in the avidya, in the ignorance, there is no link between the Purushas of the higher, even this what one might call the spiritual mind, which is in the Sahasrara and above, the, you know, causal or karana sharira and the anandamaya ananda sharira, in these realms there is no link to the prakriti, which is the avidya prakriti, you may say, the, you know, annamaya, pranamaya, manomaya prakriti. Now, the Purusha, on the other hand, whether it is the mental Purusha or whether we think of it as the psychic being, can, ultimately the Purusha within is the psychic entity and the Purusha above is the Jivatman. So the innermost Purusha, when we talk about the mental Purusha, ultimately behind it in the inner domain stands the psychic being. So the Purusha may enter into union with the cosmic Purusha at one of these planes, whether in the higher mind planes, that is through the Jivatman in the Sahasrara, or it might rise even above further into the supramental or Anandamaya planes and attain to union there. But that is the Sushupti or Turiya state, usually the Sushupti state. Either of these would land one in a Sushupti state where there is immersion of Purusha in a superconscient identity with the transcendental Purusha there. But there is no operation of Prakriti. The Prakriti, there is no nature, there is no presence and power of that Purusha that can be mobilized. Why is that? That is the reason. The reason is that it has not formed its own Prakriti. So to the extent that it can formulate or form an individualized Prakriti and bring that into connection, link it with the lower Prakriti, Avidya Prakriti, that it becomes possible for the presence and power of those Purushas to become active in our lives, just as now the Annamaya, Pranamaya and Manomaya Purushas are active in our lives. Now that's the reason why, I mean, recently we were conducting some studies here. Richard Hartz is taking some, lessons, lectures on Record of Yoga here at present. And we went through a certain chapter in the Synthesis of Yoga where Sri Aurobindo is indicating four transformations rather than three transformations. So we usually talk about a triple transformation as the integral yoga, the steps of the integral yoga. A triple transformation consists of the psychic being coming to the front and psychicizing the nature, then rising into union with the overmental Purusha and overmentalizing the nature. That is, at that point, creating an overmental personality and then bringing that into the lower avidya completely. And thirdly, going further above and uniting with the supramental Purusha and formulating a supramental personality, which would then completely enter into the lower avidya. But for this to happen, an even more preliminary stage is needed, and that is to bring out of latency the mental vital Purushas that are operating in our subliminal being. So that mobilizing of the subliminal personality, mobilizing of the what he sometimes calls the yogic personality, has to precede the psychic transformation. So that is the whole idea of living within, coming into contact with, even the other Purushas of the inner being, and having some degree of control over the nature from there, before the entirety of the psychic sort of contact, influence, and transformation can take place.
Yeah, thank you, Devajit. I think this is very useful because I think when we see it as a triple transformation, then the first leap itself is a very big leap. So it's much more useful to have them in little more, bite-sized steps, so to say.
Absolutely. You see, that's the thing, that the first step itself is such a big leap that people often don't achieve it in their whole lifetime. Or they only have an inkling of it or only a portion of it. But if one can see it in terms of, more intermediate steps, then it becomes much more, doable and clear.
So the process of coming in contact with the true purushas of the mind and the vital and the physical, I suppose by physical we mean getting into the subtle physical, correct?
Yes, yes,
so
correct.
this process, I mean, would be similar to, I mean, what Sri Aurobindo says for the psychic transformation of, you know, the process itself is similar of aspiration, rejection and surrender and concentrating in the heart, but just that these are the steps that would arrive before the psychic transformation. Is that correct? Or has he spelled out different steps, so to say, for that?
Yeah, no, the steps he has spelled out for that, you're essentially right. But the concentration on the heart really is aimed at bringing one into contact with the psychic being. In this case, the process lies in the triple purification. Purification of the mental being, of actually particularly the key is the purification of the mental being. So what he calls the antahkarana, and the, you know, chapter The Power of the Instruments in Yoga of Self-Perfection deals with this,
mm-hmm.
that, you know, the instrument, which is the karana, has to be purified, and to the extent that we can purify it, the purusha will emerge. That is his basic premise there. So that becomes the way of, you know, the kind of watching of the thoughts, the, you know, process of meditation, the process of, you know, dissolving the ego, concentrating on the fact that all this is the Brahman. A variety of exercises of that kind are included there to bring one, of course, dissolution of the ego is a very, very far step, but, you know, the purification of the inner being is what he goes into over there. That is really the process by which the inner being sort of emerges, the yogic consciousness, as he says, emerges and makes it much more possible for the next stage, which is the psychic transformation.
Thank you, Vashishtha. Very useful.
Vashishtha, I have a question on the, you said the formulation of the prakritis, once we go beyond
yes.
the mental or above the mental level, are we talking of those, for example, the Ashta Siddhi and the different Siddhis that people get, so that's kind of an action or putting a power in
yeah.
action?
No, you're right there. You're absolutely right. The Ashta Siddhi, which actually the term Ashta Siddhi appears in Patanjali in his Yoga Sutras, but it's not defined what are the Ashta Siddhis in Patanjali's case. It's only his commentators that have given names to these eight Siddhis. Sri Aurobindo has his own list of eight Siddhis, and they are a part of the Vijnana Chatushtaya. But when he's talking about the Vijnana Chatushtaya, you are actually absolutely right. They begin right from the entry into the Sahasrara and the levels of the spiritual mind. So that's the beginning, and entering, they start operating more and more purely once from what he has called the intuition plane. From there, these Ashta Siddhis, Siddhis start becoming really more active. But it is in forming the, in making the link between the nature and the Purusha at those planes, that the operation of these Ashta Siddhis becomes, you know, kind of, you know, that they become operative, so to say. They are part of the Vijnana Chatushtaya in his record of yoga.
But the Siddhis are actually part of the Prakriti nature. Prakriti.
Yeah, the Siddhis are the operation of Vijnana sort of consciousness in the nature.
Mm-hmm. And
there he actually goes through, it's interesting you brought this up, because there's a whole, when he discusses the Vijnana Chatushtaya, you'll see in the record of yoga, even right at the beginning when he's describing the Chatushtaya, he suddenly takes a break and gives you 2 pages of about the siddhis, and he says, you know, what are the siddhis, what attitude should we have towards them, etc. And the prime point he's making over there is that once we start formulating this this unformulated prakriti, that is the nature of the supermind or the nature of the spiritual mind, is such that the operation of these prakritis is natural there. So if we don't formulate the nature, it's fine. We can enter into a blissful union with the Purusha, which is what many yogis do, and that's it. But if we want to operate with those powers as a divine being in life, then it becomes necessary to assume that kind of nature. And that kind of nature comes naturally with these siddhis. So part of the formation of that nature involves becoming more and more receptive to these powers and forces of the Purusha of that plane. That is why he is going through this very rigorous kind of, you know, exercise of noting down day by day how these operate, how he can observe them, how he can purify them, how he can differentiate them, how he can distinguish between different kinds of their action, etc. See, that is the entire utility to him of the record of yoga. Record of yoga could be seen from a certain point of view as the record of the formation of these unformulated natures within himself.
Okay, yeah, that's very nice. So the all the experiments and those flowering of those siddhis, those are what are the when we say formulation of the nature in that higher plane, so that's what we mean.
Yes, that's at least as I understand it.
So for in the higher plane, these siddhis are actually the karanas. Just like the intelligence is a karana of the mental plane or instrument of the mental plane.
See, karana would mean a faculty, actually. Instrument in that sense of faculty. You could say, but the faculty would be like, for example, sometimes will give you the faculty. For example, Smriti and Shruti are two karanas. Okay? But through Smriti, a certain Vijnana Shakti will act. That Vijnana Shakti, two Vijnana Shaktis act through the Smriti. They are, you know, those, he says, discrimination and intuition. Okay. Then, that is through Smriti. Okay. Then through Shruti, he says, revelation and inspiration are the two Vijnana Shaktis that will act through the Karana of Shruti. See, so that is, you have to distinguish, because sometimes he goes to the extent of calling these powers not only Shaktis but actual goddesses. See, one place he says Ishita, Vashita and Aishwarya are the three goddesses of the Isha. Okay, so we can even look at them in that way. And not just when we use the word Shakti, it can be used very literally to mean goddess powers. But faculties, nature, are the Karana, as you said, through which these goddesses will act. So we have to activate the Karana so that the Shakti can act through it.
That means the karanas are still in the physical plane.
No, karanas are not in the physical plane. See that, for example, we just use the term Shruti and Smriti. So Smriti, for example, will be very different from the nature of our, you know, even mental. Firstly, it would be a mental activity. But though we might say there is a physical Smriti also, body has its own memory. But power of Smriti, active, for example, in body, in vital, in the psychic. In the psychic, we have the psychic memory. So too, we have forms of memory in these higher planes. That is the reason why when you have true discrimination occurring, then it comes with a sense that, you know, I already know this. You know, that sense, I already know this. This has always been. Is because you're tapping into something which is already present in the supermind as part of the Trikal Drishti. It is, in fact, all these powers of Vijnana take their root in the Trikal Drishti because it has already happened, you see. So that is why it is of the nature of Smriti. But that kind of Smriti is very different from the operation of mental Smriti, remembrance in the lower nature. So it is the opening up of a faculty which is possible to us as a kind of intuition here, but is very rare. But there it becomes much more the nature, the constant nature. And that chair has to replace this nature. That is the whole process of creating or formulating that nature within us. It's latent and in some sense unformulated. So it is formulated within this nature by replacing its operations.
Devashishta, can you please relate this one to the internatal journey that is being discussed? I kind of lost that.
Relate which? What?
To the internatal journey and that is being discussed here.
Yeah, the internatal journey is basically that to the extent that these inner beings are well developed, that the nature of Prakriti is well developed. See, it's the actually the development of the Prakriti, the inner Prakriti, that is going to allow the Purushas to operate in these worlds. Otherwise, it cannot operate. It will just get dissolved or it will fall into, sleep. So, you know, to the extent that your inner vital being, for example, is well formed, to the extent that your inner mental being is well formed, it is well formed meaning that in your life on earth, that particular Prakriti is active in its commerce with its own pain. Beings and forces of the mind world are constantly descending and, you know, kind of operating in a native way there. It is not some sporadic and freak occurrence, but something which has had some settled existence in you. Similarly, the formulation of these higher planes, if we can achieve it in this life, if we can achieve a causal Prakriti, a supramental Prakriti or spiritual mind Prakriti in this life, so that it becomes to some extent part of our normal existence, then we will have a well-formed, you know, whatever, over-mental body or supramental body or whatever, so that even if when we lose this particular physical sheath, in the journey, in the internatal journey of the psychic being, we will have a certain well-formed Prakriti that will operate in those worlds. So that is what this is.
So, Debashishna, so just as, I mean, somebody in a human being might, develop his mind or his mental powers, he would be doing all certain kinds of exercises. So, really, the process of formulating this is that the being is able to dwell in those planes, and then he's similarly perfecting himself by means of various exercises. So that is the process of formulation. Is that correct?
Yeah, actually part process of formulation is bringing their forces into one's nature. So basically that's the reason why he says the physical nature is like the key in which all these forces are operating with their own personalities. So to the extent that we can bring those forces into the physical nature, we can make them active in the physical nature, to that extent we are forming a well-formed personality. They are getting, you know, a certain shape and form. So that physical, by physical nature, we mean not necessarily, you know, the ordinary, I mean, in the case of the record, you see most ordinary things, he's using these things on ants and on crows and all kinds of things, as well as on world events taking place as far as Ireland and Turkey. But you see, the thing is that these are being exercised, you're right, they're being exercised, and gradually being made to become the ordinary form of operation in the nature.
Yeah, thank you, Devashishta. Very fascinating, to say the least.
Yeah, yeah. Now, Shanta had a question she has sent me on the chat. Can you repeat that question in words, Shanta, please? Oh, I have a feeling she doesn't have...
She sent it to all of us.
Uh-huh.
Oh, probably
I couldn't understand that question properly, so I'm wondering... let's see, what does the question say?
Do you want me to read that? Or?
Yeah, okay, could you read it?
So it says, is it true that once we understand these siddhis, these can be used for enhancing the psychic being? And I guess this is the next sentence. Which comes first, formulation of the physical being or after the enhancement of the psychic being? The siddhis are attained. So, I mean, as I understand, I guess the question is whether the siddhis, formulating the siddhis can be useful for attaining the psychic being, or is it that after the psychic being is attained, then we go on to work with these siddhis? That's, I mean, I'm, I don't know how fair it is.
No, you see the... you see these siddhis, actually, you know, the Ashta Siddhi is talking about does not have any relation with the psychic being per se to begin with. Psychic being can come to the front quite independently, and it doesn't depend on the development of the psychic being doesn't depend on these at all. But in the conscious journey of conscious evolution, the psychic being proceeds to a certain point where these become you know, part of its domain of nature, of control, because it enters into union with the Purushas of the higher planes. So from that point of view, it really has no impact on the psychicization of the nature as we know it, or on the, you know, necessity for kind of developing these powers outside of you know, whatever sadhana we are doing for the psychic being. Now, on the other hand, if you're talking about the inner being, there are siddhis associated with the inner being also. In fact, when we are talking about the first stage, which is the activating of the yogic consciousness, a lot of these other powers, the Vijnanamaya powers that he's talking about, are actually replacing the powers of the inner being in him, in his case. I mean, it's very fascinating if you look at it, when he's actually looking at the operation of his own intuition, he's distinguishing not merely between normal mental operations of reason and, you know, common sense and inference and all that, but he's also distinguishing between inner mind intuition and these kinds of intuitions. Sometimes he's saying that the interference of the intuition of the inner mind. So the subliminal being, what he sometimes calls the yogic consciousness, which would in a way be the entry into the inner being, and the, you know, the identification with at least one of the mental, vital or physical purushas, or whatever what he calls is the central being in each one of us, also brings in its train certain siddhis. because the subliminal being opens up the gate between the physical and the, you know, the inner cosmic worlds. In fact, if we look at Savitri, we'll find that Savitri's own yoga is entirely achieved in that dimension. She enters into the inner worlds through an entry into the subliminal being, ultimately achieving a full union with the soul, a psychic being. So, the extent to which one develops the inner or yogic being is relative. Not everybody needs to develop it to the same extent as, say, Savitri develops it. But at the same time, to whatever extent one develops it, there are siddhis that come with that also. Now, these don't necessarily have any impact on the psychic being, but they may be an aid to the emergence of the psychic being. This happens, in fact, in Savitri, because you see, when Savitri is in search for her soul, you have the soul powers that come on the journey and kind of point her in a certain direction, though they also mislead her. Each one of them says to her, I am your true being, you see. So the entire subliminal world with its own powers and personalities is a tricky one, and one has to develop great discrimination either from above or from within to negotiate that world. So it isn't that one has to first completely develop the inner personality and then only one can get to the psychic. It has to go on simultaneously.
I guess in a way the question was directed at where to place the aspiration first.
Yeah, I think the answer is the aspiration has to be placed simultaneously on these two aspects at least first. Actually, there are three aspects to place the aspiration simultaneously. Aspiration on the heart, and from there aspiration, you know, the increase of the contact with the divine, you know, Shakti, that is the divine mother. Secondly, the aspiration on the inner being, that is through the purification of the Antakarana. And thirdly, the aspiration on the planes above the mind by receptivity to their forces and powers. These three kinds of operations, I think, have to go simultaneously in us. And some will predominate at certain stage and others will predominate, because ultimately yoga is being done by the yoga Shakti. We only have a certain amount of control over its processes. But as we enter into the journey, something else starts dictating what will happen when.
Very nice, Devashita. Thank you. This discrimination that you are talking about that Sri Aurobindo was doing, as to find out where each movement is coming from, that requires a very high degree of subtlety or dexterity, right? Because each of these things, I mean, you may think it is an intuition, but really, I mean, even at a most mundane level, you may think something is an intuition, but it's really an inference based on a lot of data that you've had before.
Yes, it could be. Or it could be a misleading inner mind movement. You see, very rapid inner mind movement based on some misleading force. So when you're talking about discrimination, that itself is the more and more an infallible higher power must discriminate. So in terms of the development of these higher Shaktis, one may even say she is the first, the power of discrimination. So whether from the psychic, there is a psychic discrimination that gives us a certain feeling on what is the actual sense of comfort, one may say, to something. You know, the psychic discrimination operates like that. To the extent that it grows, you receive a certain direction and you test it by the psychic discrimination. It just either kind of tells you, you know, that there's a certain shadow here. There's a kind of feeling of, you know, discomfort. Okay. So that is one, you know, dimension of discrimination. The other dimension is the opening up of the discrimination of the higher mind planes and finally its origin in the supermind. And that itself is a form of intuition. So when we are talking about intuitions, the development of the intuitive faculty of discrimination is the most important and first thing. That becomes more and more infallible, as he says. It becomes a perception from a kind of a, you know, a form of truth perception where it immediately kind of picks out and shows you that, no, this is not right, this is right, this is different from that or whatever. That operation happens very, very quickly.
Devashishta?
Yes,
a few minutes ago you were talking about three aspirations. In,
yes.
I got one in the heart center, one above the mind, and then I missed out on the other.
The other is, the third is on the purification of the inner being. That is through watching the thoughts, through developing discrimination, to develop the inner being so that one has the right attitude, you know. So those kind of inner qualities, the purification of the inner being is really the door to the subliminal realization, the coming to the front of the mental, vital and physical purushas.
Okay, thank you.
Devashishta, how much of this formulation is a conscious process? Basically, in other words, if it is, there is dissolution is also another, if the formulation is not, if the attempt to formulate is not there, the alternative is to dissolve, right? So yes. how much of it is a conscious process, really? Where does the will play a role here?
Yeah, it's a very good question, because the will does play a very important role. The will plays what is the role of aspiration? Aspiration and faith are very, very closely connected. They both belong to a certain domain, which decides for us what will be the achievement in this life. That's the reason why he's saying you are what your faith is. So it is the awakening of the faith and the aspiration which ultimately connects you to a certain possibility. If that connection is not there, then you will end up at a certain level and think or take it to be the end. See? To the extent of our aspiration is our achievement. So that it may also not be that, because you see, it's not only, this makes it sound as if everything is in our hands. It may not be that, as say, for example, in the case of Sri Aurobindo himself, who did not really aspire for the spiritual life, but it came to him unbidden. Now, in that case, we have to say that it was all, like, in his case, these so-called unformulated cheats may already have been very well formulated, you see. And he just had to sort of create some amount of connection between them and his normal existence, which is what he's doing. But in most cases, were it not for a certain aspiration that connects us to these possibilities, we would not even enter into their, the thing that he's talking about regarding the commerce with these higher planes would not even occur, and we'd just enter into them and go to sleep. whether in life or outside it.
Thank you.
If you fall, that's the reason why there is a well, Shanta has asked a question, but let me complete the thought from Sitaram's question, which is that if we I think I've lost my train of thought. Anyway, it'll probably come back. Yeah, what I was going to say basically is that if you are presented with a certain truth. Now, these things are all truths, like let's say the same thing. Let's say five people read Vivekananda's book, Jnana Yoga. One of them, it makes no sense. That person reads it and says, this is total nonsense. I can't believe anything that he's saying at all. Basically, the premise through the book is what you're seeing with your eyes is an illusion. And there is a reality beyond this illusion, and that reality is unitary, it is one, it is not a differentiated reality. And through a certain process of discrimination, of introspection, and you know, of detachment, we come into union with that, and once we come into union with that, we remain there, and what we saw as reality becomes unreal to us. This in a nutshell is the premise of Jnana Yoga. Now, one person may say, this is nonsense. I mean, this world is real to me. There is, I don't believe what he's saying, that there is anything behind this world. Okay. Another person may say, this is very true. Now, how or why did that person say this is very true? It can't be due to imagination. It is due to the stirring of a kind of memory. That is, already I know that this is true. So if that arises, immediately along with it, there awakens an aspiration. I would like to realize this. A third person may feel, yes, this is true, but there is something yet unsaid over here, something that is not clear over here. It does not fully satisfy me. Okay. See, that was, for example, in Sri Aurobindo's case, where he got the nirvana unbidden, but he notes that it did not quench his aspiration. He says, a realization which left the world as it is was felt by me to be distasteful. Okay, so evidently something in him was not totally answered by that thing. Now, he had not read anything. Or maybe he had, but it hadn't really made an impact on him before he had his realization. But it might be that if he had, the aspiration may not have responded to it in the same way as the aspiration of the second person. Took it to be, this is the truth, because I remember this is the truth. There is something in me which tells me this is the truth. Only thing worth following. Okay. Now the third person may feel this is a partial truth. Okay, that it might not carry that same ring of conviction that it carried for the second person. This means that there is in that person already an aspiration awake that is looking for something else. Now, if this person were to come across another kind of teaching, it is possible that there would be a response which was more complete. See? So that is where aspiration comes in, and the development of aspiration in us is a very complex thing, and as it develops, the possibility of realization also develops.
So formulation is not an automatic process, or is it?
No, formulation what? Of the nature, as he's talking about here, or formulation of the goal to oneself?
Formulation of goal to oneself.
It's not an automatic process. No, it is certainly not an automatic process. But there are samskaras involved there. You see, that's why I said if you have three people, you can't expect person one, you can't push it down his throat that no, this is truth. Okay? So to person two, you can't push it down his throat that no, there is more to it than this. And third person, you can't push it down his throat that, you know, these two positions are not, I mean, are all there is to reality. Why? Because there are samskaras involved in it. You know, we already have some tendencies that allow us to develop the aspiration in certain ways. So it's not, that's why I said it's a complex thing. It's not difficult to tell beforehand what it is that one has sort of chosen, the psychic being has perhaps chosen in a certain life, a certain kind of, you know, fulfillment or realization.
So there can be a highly evolved yogi who might basically, like lot of times in the stories we hear, that might be a yogi who might be meditating in Himalayas, let us say, and that might not formulate into any type of action or any type of, it might not manifest something. That's what I mean. Like, where does the act like bringing the power of tapas into the nature come into picture?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, that basically it amounts to that, you know, are we achieving some kind of a union with Purusha alone, an identity with Purusha in which we stay merged in a state of superconscious bliss? Or are we bringing the tapas of that Purusha into the activity of our life? Now, that bringing the tapas into the activity in some kind of nature is a formulation that ultimately needs the adherence of the psychic being. The psychic being's aspiration must be for it. If the psychic being's aspiration is not for it, if the psychic being's aspiration is for laya or for, you know, sort of mukti, then it will not, you know, sort of, that is the whole thing that is related to adhikar and also to the will of the psychic. But if on the other hand, aspiration and will of the psychic being is for bringing to, you know, to the world, the action of that Purusha, then that will happen. That does not need to, even the yogi sitting in the Himalayan cave could be doing that. Because that is exactly what he's saying. I mean, the whole thing about Sri Aurobindo sitting in his room and controlling sort of thoughts of some people in Ireland is an example of that, that these powers are being mobilized. Nobody will know any difference from whether he is in Sushupti or he is actually affecting some things by tapas.
The Vasishtha, that first movement that you talked about in the, not the triple, the quadruple transformation, the movement of inner purification, is that what is called Brahmacharya?
Brahmacharya is one aspect of it, but you know, it's the whole field of Shuddhi. In the Chatushtas, that is what is the whole quartet of, you know, sort of Siddhi Chatushta, which proceeds by Shuddhi to attain to Mukti. That Mukti is the liberation of the inner being and the realization of universal, of unity of Purusha with universal Purushas, mental, vital and physical. That's the ultimate end of that particular phase, the inner being, you know, Siddhi.
So I was reading
and control of Prakriti at those planes.
So in that Chatushtaya, when we say Mukti, that is still not same as the realization of the psychic being. That's so you're saying that's more of contact with the inner Purush, in mental Purusha. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, Mukti actually also has its stages. In that Chatushtaya, Mukti proceeds by dissolving the sense of separate reality for the mental prakriti, vital prakriti, physical prakriti, coming into identification with the mental Purusha, vital Purusha and physical Purusha, and then going beyond to see all these as various forms of one Purusha and one prakriti. So that is where it moves out from the avidya to the vidya. That is also part of Mukti, but it proceeds along these lines. It first starts through the inner being and then proceeds to the higher being. Now, psychic being doesn't come in there actually. In that particular line, psychic being doesn't come in. Psychic being is operating independently and may merge with that line at a certain point. When that line achieves its higher, you know, poise, there it finds its union with psychic being. Now, this may not necessarily be the formulation in any of our cases or all of our cases, but that was the way it proceeded in his own life. In Sri Aurobindo's own yoga, psychic power was mobilized throughout. In all the Chatushtayas, there is the power of surrender which is being mobilized. But explicit, you know, sort of reference to psychic being is not there.
Debashista, I was reading that essay he wrote called The Brain of India. Do you recall that essay?
Yes.
I would think he wrote it before he came to Pondicherry and started writing the diary, right? The Record of Yoga?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. It was written in Calcutta during the nationalist period.
Yeah. So there he talks about, there are just a few paragraphs where he talks about this kind of yogic shakti, and he talks of how retas can be transformed to jyoti and vidyut and all those things. So are these ideas, are they formulated in different fashion in Sri Aurobindo's writings?
Yeah, they continue. These ideas continue in his writings. These ideas, you know, are also present in the record.
But apart from the record, did he put it in like synthesis or some other book that is available for the public to read?
I think, you know, I'm not sure. One will have to go through the Yoga of Self-Perfection, but I think it is there. In the letters, it is there. But, you know, whether in synthesis of yoga it is there, if it is there, it will be in the Yoga of Self-Perfection. One has to see. I'll have to look more closely at it.
Because that whole idea or the whole line of thinking sounded very much like the tantric way of thinking. So I was wondering if he came out with it as a process or methodology.
Yeah, I don't know. I'll have to check. Actually, that's very interesting what you say, because there are, at least in the yoga, in the record, you know, that there is an entire, a whole lot. Ultimately, the sort of one understanding of the whole goal of Sri Aurobindo's yoga is ananda. That, as he says, to use the method of the Vedanta to achieve the ends of the Tantra. This phrase he gives in the synthesis itself. Mm-hmm. So, bhukti, that's why mukti and bhukti. So, bhukti becomes the goal. Mukti is the means to that goal. Not only karma, that is the other. There are two. Karma and bhukti are the two major goals of this yoga. Karma relies on tapas, but bhukti relies on purification of ananda. So that whole, you know, there's a whole bunch of siddhis connected with ananda, vivid ananda they are called. So that is an entire area that he does not talk about too much in his public writings.
Why do you think he doesn't talk about it?
I don't know, Lopa, but my sense is that, you see, it's easy to misunderstand some of those things that he's talking about unless there is a total purification of the nature. It is very easy to mix mm-hmm. it up with lower movements. Mm-hmm. So the purification part he touches on, but the consequences which one sees, you know, him talking about in the record to some extent, he does not detail in his public writings. Now, I am told now that he details quite a lot of some of these things in his letters, but those letters have not been printed. And as things stand right now, it seems they will never be printed.
Devashish?
Yes, Vince.
I want to ask you about the, I don't know where I read it, but you wrote somewhere that Sri Aurobindo says that there's four types of knowledge in the supramental. Supramental knowledge can be divided into four types.
Yes, yes.
I was wondering, where actually is that? Is that in his general writings or is that in the record?
Well, it's there in the record, but where it occurs, in his general writings, it occurs in the synthesis of yoga, in the yoga of self-perfection.
Explicitly?
Explicitly. In a few places, but most so in the chapter called the supramental sense.
Okay.
Now, that's one place. Then the other place where he talks about this in detail is in his, interpretation of the Kena Upanishad.
Shanta had one question.
Yes, yes, I'm sorry. Okay, just a moment. I think Bindu Mohanty wants to join the conference. I'll tell you what her...
Can you put it in chat? For the title?
Yeah, once I'll do that.
Where does he divide knowledge into four types? What is the source of that?
Okay, I'm trying to see where is my
knowledge.
Chat. Okay, I got it.
No, he just asked where is the source of that information, and Devashish said it's in the Kena Upanishad.
Yeah.
and another conversation, another chapter called the supranatural sense. I think it's either here or in synthesis of yoga. Oh, I think in synthesis of yoga, the supranatural sense. Very last one or two chapters.
Got it.
Okay, so now as far as Shanta's question is concerned, her question was, can we gauge ourselves how far we have developed our psychic beings? You see, one thing is that concentration on the psychic and its relationship with the divine is something that, you know, has its influence on the whole being. To gauge how far we have developed our psychic being, actually not developed our psychic being, I'd say perhaps what you want to ask is, to what extent are we conscious of our psychic being, or to what extent has the psychic being come to the front? If that is the case, then the answer would be, okay, one second.
Oh, hi. Is this the actual class right now?
Yes.
Okay. Yes, Bindu.
I didn't realize that.
So I'm answering a question here from Shanta. She's asking, how can we gauge how far we have developed our psychic beings? And I'm supposing what she means is, how far can we gauge how conscious we are of our psychic beings, or how far it has come to the front? And I'd say, you know, the sense, the concentration on the psychic being develops a certain sense, an inner sense, which becomes more and more palpable regarding the sense of right and wrong. It's a kind of a feeling. Now, this may not be infallible, because there is a mixture with other kinds of natural movements. So one cannot necessarily trust it fully, though one purifies that sense. But the growth of that sense in one is one sign of the psychic being's influence and coming to the front. More important, sort of characteristic of the psychic being's presence, contact, is the sense of the divine everywhere and at all times. So if that feeling throughout the day that the divine is close to one, the mother is close to me, or even if one doesn't want to call it the mother, in some way or form, the sense of the divine as being pervading everything and being close to one, that is one symptom, one may say, of the coming to the front of the psychic being. I mean, to that extent.
Shall we move to the next paragraph?
Okay.
Actually, I have one more question regarding this one. I just want to get an idea of transcendently simple character with popular which the popular religions imagine. Basically, he's talking about the. For example, the Hindu concept of hell and heaven, or in any religion, the concepts of hell, this type of worlds, people or religions imagine, is that what he is referring to?
Yes, yes. Also the notion that, yeah, exactly, that the kind of popular notions about journey of the soul, sort of through heavens and hells and things like that. And those are the kind of journeys that he's saying. Those are not the way it happens, because this, it's very closely related to this evolutionary, you know, purpose.
Shall we move on to the next one? Jyoti, would you like to read?
Sorry about that. I don't even have my book in front of me, I'm sorry.
Lopa, are you reading?
Yeah, I can read the next paragraph. If this view of rebirth and the soul's temporary passage into other planes of existence is correct, both rebirth and the afterlife assume a different significance from the color put on them by the long current belief about reincarnation and the after-death sojourn in worlds beyond us. Reincarnation is commonly supposed to have two aspects, metaphysical and moral, an aspect of spiritual necessity, an aspect of cosmic justice and ethical discipline. The soul, in this view or for this purpose supposed to have a real individual existence, is on earth as a result of desire and ignorance. It has to remain on earth or return to it always so long as it has not wearied of desire and awakened to the fact of its ignorance and to the true knowledge. This desire compels it to return always to a new body. It must follow always the revolving wheel of birth till it is enlightened and liberated. It does not, however, remain always on earth, but alternates between earth and other worlds, celestial and infernal, where it exhausts its accumulated store of merit or demerit due to the enactment of sin or virtue, and then returns to the earth and to some kind of terrestrial body, sometimes human, sometimes animal, sometimes even vegetable. The nature of this new incarnation and its fortunes are determined automatically by the soul's past actions, karma. If the sum of past action was good, the birth is in the higher form, the life happy or successful or unaccountably fortunate. If bad, a lower form of nature may house us, or the life, if human, will be unhappy, unsuccessful, full of suffering and misfortune. If our past actions and character were mixed, then nature, like a good accountant, gives us, according to the pitch and values of our formal conduct, a well-assorted payment of mixed happiness and suffering, success and failure, the rarest good luck and the severest ill fortune. At the same time, a strong personal will or desire in the past life may also determine our new avatar. A mathematical aspect is often given to these payments of nature, for we are supposed to incur a precise penalty for our misdeeds, undergo or return the replica or equivalent of what we have inflicted or enacted. The inexorable rule of a tooth for a tooth is a frequent principle of the karmic law. For this law is an arithmetician with his abacus as well as a judge with his code of penalties for long past crimes and misdemeanors. It is also to be noted that in this system, there is a double punishment and a double reward for sin and virtue. For the sinner is first tortured in hell and afterwards afflicted for the same sins in another life here, and the righteous or the Puritan is rewarded with celestial joys and afterwards again pampered for the same virtues and good deeds in a new terrestrial existence. Pretty hilarious.
Yeah, so here he's summing up the popular notion of reincarnation. In terms of the life, not just the afterlife, so long he has considered the afterlife as what he calls the internatal journey. But in this paragraph, he is returning to what it means to our existence as a rebirth. So as he points out over here, it is really that which is related to an aspect of spiritual necessity, which is moral and metaphysical. And on the other hand, an aspect of cosmic justice and ethical discipline. As he has pointed out, he holds to neither of those views because he has related it in a very, very close sort of weft. As he says, all is a closely woven web to the purpose of evolution and to the journey of cosmic force in its evolutionary purpose through conscious, through individualized conscious beings. So this kind of a karmic sort of law is something that he presents at first, as he does over here, in two aspects. One is that moral aspect of justice, of tooth for tooth, eye for eye, and on the other hand, of benefits untold for those who are righteous and good. And on the other hand, about in the sense of the kinds of lives one may have in terms of coming back into other forms of life form when being reborn. So both these notions, in a way, are not in consonance with the idea of evolution of consciousness. As he says over here, it does not, however, always remain on earth, but alternates between earth and other worlds, celestial and infernal. That's the internatal journey, as Sitaram was saying, where it exhausts its accumulated store of merit and demerit due to the enactment of sin or virtue. So there too, it is really the moral principle that drives it to experiences pain or pleasure. And then when it returns to the earth, and to some kind of terrestrial body, this terrestrial body may be, depending on what it had done before, of greater or lesser consciousness and greater or lesser state of lack of freedom, one may say. That's why he says sometimes human, sometimes animal, sometimes even vegetable. And what determines this, of course, is the soul's past actions, karma. So this is the popular notion of karma, Hindu notion of karma, that he is fielding. This has been around for a very long time. In fact, one may say that there are references in the Upanishads that may point in this direction. And by the time of Buddhism, this notion of karma has become quite common. Buddhism believes in it. And so there are two kinds of scales. One scale is a scale of freedom, so that according to the nature of the birth, or nature of the past life when one returns, one has less or greater freedom in this life. Circumstances weigh on one more heavily or less heavily. If one is born as a vegetable, naturally, one is extremely circumscribed by circumstances. If one is born as a human, it depends on what kind of life as a human one is born in. So there too, according to the Buddhist notion, good deeds will fetch you better and better circumstances of advantage in life, so that the best lives are those of kings. Now, according to them, the life of a king is ultimately a great opportunity, and that's partly the whole idea lying behind the hagiography of the Buddha as a king or a prince who becomes a renunciate. So this close sort of relation between the renunciate and the ascetic is being played out there. It is only when you have the greatest amount of freedom that you are able to choose, and the greatest choice that you can choose is the choice of asceticism. This is the sort of logic behind it. On the other hand, there is the moral logic that is also at work. So apart from the freedom aspect, which is the kind of circumstances that you experience, or life, you know, sort of circumstances that come to you, are dependent upon what it is you did in a very exact measure, in exact, you know, relation to what you did in your past life. You will get experiences of that kind in the present life. So this is the common notion of karma that he's fielding before he's going to consider it. So this paragraph, in fact, is a turning point in this chapter. Up until this point, he has been considering the whole idea of the internatal journey and of the soul's experience, as well as the jiva's experience of the rest of the subtle being after death. From this point, it is beginning to consider the whole philosophy of rebirth in terms of the experience in life and what determines it. What is the determinism that is acting in this rebirth on life, or between both between lives and in lives as a succession? So I'd say this is a good point to stop, because we enter into a totally new discussion from this point on, and he opens up this entire domain of karma from this point on in this chapter.
Sure, so we can stop now, and we plan for next Wednesday, unless there are changes.
Okay, what is the date next Wednesday, Shyam?
Next Wednesday will be the 4th of February.
Okay, so we'll have to skip that. How about 5th of February? Is that a possibility? Because 4th of February I'm traveling.
5th is definitely okay for me. I guess others, if there's anyone who is not I guess if we can't do 4th, 5th is...
Yeah, let's try for 5th, yeah. Same time.
Sure.
And yeah, because 4th I'll be traveling at this time. Uh-huh. So I'll be moving to Calcutta for the last lap of my journey here. And so we'll sort of meet again on the 5th, on Thursday.
Sure, so we'll continue on 5th Thursday then.
Oh, I'm sorry, I'm joining in for the first time. What time does it start, the class?
This is 9 o'clock India time on Friday morning. It should be next week.
I'm in India.
Yeah, on Friday morning at 9.
9 o'clock. Okay, great. Yeah. Thank you.
So we stop with a brief meditation.
Yeah.
End with.